This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. This month marks the 20th anniversary of Fresh Air's national daily broadcast, and we're celebrating by replaying some of the interviews from that first year. Our first guest is neurologist Oliver Sacks. He's still best known for his best-selling collection of case histories, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Dr. Sacks has described himself as a reporter of the human condition in extremis. His patients have severe neurological disorders, such as aphasia, Parkinson's disease, and Tourette's syndrome, disorders that have deprived them of memory, movement, cognition, or sensation. In all, Sacks has written 9 books and is a regular contributor to The New Yorker. This interview is from October 1987.
Dr. Oliver Sacks, welcome to Fresh Air.
Nice to be here.
Before we talk about the medical and spiritual implications of the work that you do, I'm going to ask you to tell the story of the man who mistook his wife for a hat, one of the case studies that you've written about. This was a music teacher and singer who didn't recognize that he had a disorder. What were the symptoms that he was showing?
The first problem was that he had difficulty recognizing his students at the music academy. As soon as they spoke, he recognized them at once, but he couldn't recognize them visually. And soon he couldn't recognize anyone or anything visually. He couldn't recognize his wife. He couldn't recognize himself. He couldn't recognize common objects. He saw them perfectly clearly, but what he saw carried no meaning for him and no sense. And this prompted him to sort of ingenious but sometimes wild and sometimes absurd guesses as to what he might be seeing.
And you titled the case study The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat because in reaching for his hat, he reached for his wife's head by mistake.
When I saw him in the first interview, he was obviously not demented, but a delightful, intelligent, civilized man with a sense of humor. He kept encountering the fact that he made mistakes, but he didn't recognize what the problem was. And it mixed with all his intactness. There was a succession of absurd mistakes. At one point, he confused his left foot with his shoe, and he didn't seem to know which was which. And then right at the end, when he went to reach for his hat, he got his wife's head instead.
What is the condition that he had?
Well, this is called a visual agnosia. And what happens is that the normal meeting between visual input, between images and a person's memories and ideas and feelings and expectations doesn't occur. And so, this goes with a problem in the visual association areas at the back of the brain. And so he sort of had raw vision, a sort of raw seeing, which didn't ascend into the realm of meaning.
Although he couldn't make sense of what he saw, he was a musician and singer, and he still had perfect musical sense. And your prescription to him was music. Why?
He was really absolutely lost in this meaningless, shattered visual world. And he desperately needed some way of organizing himself. Now, I think all of us tend to either use internal speech or internal music to organize ourselves to some extent. I mean, one has things like nursery rhymes, "One, Two, Buckle My Shoe," or marching songs or work songs. But the song, as a unit of organization, became tremendously important and crucial for this man, who was so totally lost visually, couldn't use any visual organization, but in fact was a marvelous musician and singer, and a man who sort of generated songs all the while. And one saw again and again that he couldn't dress, he couldn't shave, he couldn't eat, unless he really set the activity to music internally. On one occasion when he was eating, there was an interruption, there was a sudden, the postman suddenly knocked at the door, and this completely shattered the activity, and he looked quite bewildered for a few seconds until he was able to recapture the melody of eating.
You know, your prescription of music reminds me of something that your friend, the poet W.H. Auden, had said to you, which is that he spoke of the poetic and religious states of affliction. And I wonder what you think, how that applies to your work. The Poetic and Religious States of Affliction.
I thought you were going to actually quote one of Auden's favourite quotations from Novalis, where Novalis says, every disease is a musical problem, and every cure is a musical solution. And certainly with Dr. P, as with many of my Parkinsonian patients, people sometimes who can't move unless they sing or dance. You know, one sees absolutely they've been unmusicked by disease and can be remusicked back into health. I think that the poetic and the religious are almost sometimes an integral part of patients' perceptions as to what may be happening with them. Something I describe in the Hat book and also at more length in an earlier book, A Leg to Stand On, as a patient whom I saw as a student who had apparently lost his left leg. He was found on the floor, very bewildered. He'd apparently thrown himself out of bed in a peculiar way. And the story he gave was that he had woken up from sleep. He had found that there was a foreign leg in the bed with him, disgusting object. He threw it out, and then, and now horribly, he had come out with it, and now it was attached to him. And I said, but it's your leg? And he said, you know, shouldn't I know my own leg? And I said, yes, you should. And he said, well, I know it's not my leg. Now, this thing for him was not only was terribly wrong. It felt ugly. It felt hateful. It felt obscene. It felt unholy. It felt an offence against nature. The particular physiology in his case was that he had a tumour in the opposite side of the brain, which had expanded while he slept, and had blotted out the part of the brain which represents the leg. So the leg image had been obliterated. Therefore, he could not recognise his leg as his own. Therefore, it seemed absolutely other. But the absolutely other always seems uncanny and horrible and obscene and unholy and God-forsaken. And words like this or concepts like this will be used by every patient, irrespective of background, of intelligence, of education. The alienation is almost intrinsically in the area of subjectivity is sort of felt as anti-poetic, anti-religious. And by the same token, when it comes back, there's the feeling, to quote Dante, of the holy and glorious flesh restored. And so I think even at this level, sort of the body in health is always felt as sort of as beautiful and holy, although one may not appreciate this unless it's taken away and one suddenly deals with a radically depreciated world.
Your way of writing case studies is really very literary. It's not empirical. It's not cut and dry. You're really describing states of mind as well as neurological conditions. And I've wondered if patients talk to you that way, if they are as descriptive as you are in telling their stories.
I think obviously this will depend on the condition and the patients, but above all, I think on the situation, in that if a patient is not permitted implicitly or explicitly to talk about himself, if he's reduced, if he's given a sort of catechism, do you have this, do you have that, then he will reduce himself to a list of symptoms. He won't say what is actually like. He won't depict the world he is in, which he's been thrust into. But I think that if patients have a complaint, sometimes more serious or as serious as their primary complaint, is that they can't communicate what it's like. And I think that a major act of the doctor is somehow to, De Quincey once talked about the pressure of the incommunicable upon the heart, is to let the patient try and communicate, and the doctor must sort of help him, must reach out to delicately to assist this trembling communication. And so that between them, the way it is, the world of illness can come into being.
You've done a lot of your work on backwards of hospitals, charity hospitals, asylums. Why have you gone there looking for the kinds of cases you are interested in studying?
Well, it was really not quite in that order. I was there in places which most of my colleagues wouldn't be seen dead in, and which no ambitious young doctor would go to, and which are felt to be the sticks. But in fact, here there is there's the priceless gift of leisure. There's no pressure to diagnose. There's no pressure to do anything. Also, you can encounter a complete world. I mean, these places are really little worlds. And I think that an unpressed exploration of getting deeper and deeper is possible in such places. It's hardly possible in any other places.
There's no pressure because they're considered hopeless anyways?
Partly. This was well realized by the founders of neurology, by Hewlings, Jackson, and Charcot in the last century. They spent much of their lives in chronic hospitals, institutions, asylums. But now doctors don't. But certainly with the patients I describe in Awakenings, these people who had been in hospital for 40 years or more since the great sleeping sickness epidemic, I had no idea that such patients existed, that such lives existed, until I went into a chronic hospital.
Has that happened other times, too, that you've found disorders that have not really been described before?
Well, certainly they haven't been described with the richness and the fullness which they should have. In general, I think description has become sort of obsolete.
You've described it as almost a 19th century art in medicine.
Yeah. I love 19th century medicine and science. It may have been so short in a way on certain empirical remedies and even relatively short on physiological concepts, and of course very short on technology. But the respect for the patient and for the detail of what was happening to them, I think, could often generate almost novelistically rich and at the same time sort of medically and scientifically accurate descriptions. So much so now that there's major discoveries have been made by going back over 19th century descriptions. Now we can see what went on. I think most of the descriptions now are so meager, so threadbare, and also so they're too quick to diagnose, to pin labels on.
When you're working with patients who have been almost abandoned by the medical profession, it's just a kind of caretaking type of thing, are you able to do anything to really change their condition, or are you more interested in observing them? And let's leave out the sleeping sickness patients, because you were able to administer a new drug there that totally changed their condition. But in other cases where there isn't a drug that's going to change their state, what can you do?
My first notion is to try and understand with the patient what's going on. Now, from the understanding, treatment may come. So that, for example, with one case I describe in the HAT book, as I call it for short, as a Parkinsonian man who leant grossly to one side, although he wasn't aware of this. He was surprised that people commented. I took a videotape of this, I played it back to him. And it was only when he saw this that he realized what was happening, and he then asked a very acute question. He said he wondered whether there were balancing mechanisms. He used to be a carpenter, like spirit levels, like bubble levels, in the head, which had been impaired by his disease. And I said, yeah, exactly. And he then thought again, and he wondered if one couldn't make such little levels outside the head, for example, attached to by a nose clip to the glasses, and whether this would serve to balance him. And I said, it's a wonderful idea, let's try it. And in fact, it worked beautifully. Now, here is a man who, all I did, in a sense, was to...
Give him a metaphor.
yes, I, did, right? or he gave himself a metaphor. No, I assisted his understanding and indeed his movement to a cure. I mean, I love this sort of collaboration. when it's possible.
I thank you very much for talking with us about your work. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Oliver Sacks speaking with Terry Gross in 1987.